Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
You're listening to Soundcheck. You're listening to Sound with John Schaefer. You're listening to Soundcheck. You're listening to Soundcheck.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and today I've been thinking about aliens. Actually, I've been thinking about us, human beings, and how incredibly stupid we can be. You know how NASA sent that golden record on the Voyager missions, the ones that are currently heading out of the solar system? That record is supposed to represent us to whatever aliens eventually find it. Okay, fine. That's not the dumb part. Here's the dumb part. Okay, you're an alien, and you hear this. Now, does this say we Earthlings are a scary, warlike, and probably inedible race? You'll want to stay far away? Or does it make us sound like the galactic version of the kid whose lunch money you're going to steal? I mean, what was NASA thinking? Well, today, we'll learn what NASA was thinking, and seriously, it was pretty fascinating. Also, back on Earth, we'll hear from Detroit singer-songwriter Shara Warden and her band My Brightest Diamond. Let's start, though, with the writer and producer, Anne Drian. Anne led the team that decided what would be on that NASA golden record, which was launched into space on Voyager 1 and 2 35 years ago in the summer of 77. These days, Anne runs Cosmos Studios, which carries on the work of her late husband, the astronomer Carl Sagan. He also worked on the golden record, and between them, Anne and Carl and the team selected images of human bodies and text. There were greetings in 55 languages. There's even a record of Anne Drian's own brainwaves. But a lot of that Voyager record consists of music, and we've called Anne to find out how she and her team picked that music. Anne, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you for having me.
This project is such a quirky, kind of quixotic idea. How did you get involved in it?
Well, you could say quirky or quixotic, or you could say epic, mythic, romantic. I got involved
optimistic.
In it. Optimistic. I got involved in it because it was my honor to know Carl Sagan and Frank Drake. And during the early days of preparation for Voyager, they asked me if I would be the creative director of the project, knowing of my abiding love for all kinds of music, and I think it was kind of a great compliment to and an honor to be asked to do this.
Now, the Golden Record has, as we know, lots of stuff on it. In terms of picking the music, how did you do that? How did you select from an entire planet's worth of music?
Well, no, it's like the supreme act of hubris. You know, people who've really never heard a single piece of Chinese music selecting the one piece from a 2,500-year-long continuous musical tradition to go into eternity. So, you know, we had a very healthy respect for our ignorance. And so Tim Ferriss and I consulted ethnomusicologists, great Alan Lomax, people who really knew their music in a variety of cultures. And it was a kind of, you know, it was a very concerted effort to fill in the blanks for the traditions that we just knew nothing about.
Mm-hmm. Let's hear just a tiny sample of what Anne's talking about. This is from the so-called Golden Record, just a couple of the more than two dozen selections that are hurtling beyond the solar system on Voyagers 1 and 2.
Der Herr Rache kostet meine Herzen. deep down in Louisiana, close to New Orleans, way back up in the woods among the evergreens, there stood a log cabin made of earth and wood, where lived a country boy named Johnny B. Good, who never ever learned to read or write so well, but he could play a guitar just like a ringing a bell. Go, go!
A couple of excerpts from the so-called Golden Record that were sent out on the twin spacecrafts Voyager 1 and 2 back in 1977. Traditional pygmy music from Zaire, Mozart's Queen of the Night aria, Johnny B. Good, of course. And Andrian is with me on the line. She was the creative director of NASA's Voyager Interstellar Message. And in terms of, you know, working with Carl Sagan, it was more than just a professional relationship at some point, right? This is where you two met and fell in love?
No, actually, we had met years before. And, you know, knew each other as colleagues and friends for years. But you're quite right, John. It was during the making of this message to a billion years from now that Carl and I fell madly in love. And we discovered, you know, our feelings for each other, or we were willing to even recognize them, on a phone call in the discussion of that piece of Chinese music, a long-distance phone call. And that was the aperture to 20 years of the most transcendent happiness for the rest of Carl's life. We married and had children. And one of the great things about that record is that my brainwaves, my vital signs, every neurological electrical impulse that my body could put out was recorded within days of this revelation of our love for each other. And then it was turned into data, compressed into sound, and it's on those two Voyager spacecraft, which are the most distant objects ever touched by human hands, mm-hmm. leaving our solar system, sailing the vast ocean of interstellar space. And so if the engineers and scientists who brilliantly designed the spacecraft and projected a 1,000 million year lifetime mm-hmm. for those records, moving at about 40,000 miles an hour.
The way you describe, your feelings, the beginnings of your relationship with Carl as sort of being woven into the fabric of these records is, it's so poetic, but on a kind of nuts and bolts level, if I may. Are you talking about the music, the sequencing, that particular Chinese work? Is that the DNA, so to speak, of your relationship that you were talking about?
Well, I think it's all of that, and I think it's also the pale blue dot, which is based on an image taken by Voyager looking back at the solar system just when it was out by Neptune and seeing the true tininess of our world. It's the entire gestalt of the entire experience. It's in there. You know, I think that the first use of the word world music, which is a concept we've all come to embrace, is about the same time as Voyager. In fact, Robert O. Brown, who coined that phrase, he helped us in picking this music. It's about a different kind of cosmic perspective that Carl Sagan articulated more poetically and more clearly than probably anyone else who's ever lived. And the idea that Voyager lives on beyond all of us, beyond the Great Wall of China, beyond the configuration of the continents, Blind Willie Johnson performing Dark Was the Night, that's science. And that's all. That's the best we have to offer as human beings. And no matter how we mess up things here, there's some small consolation that those two spacecraft will carry within them some of the greatest aspects of being alive in the beautiful spring of 1977.
We're speaking with Andrian, who was the creative director of NASA's Voyager Interstellar Message Project, the so-called Golden Record. And as Anne has told us, this song, very special to her and to Carl Sagan, the astronomer and astrophysicist working with her on the project. The Chinese piece known as Flowing Streams, performed on the qin, a traditional Chinese instrument, by Quan Pinghu. From the Golden Record, streaming out of our galaxy aboard Voyager 1 and Voyager 2, launched by NASA in 1977, we're speaking with Anne Drian, who was creative director of the Interstellar Message Project of NASA's Voyager, and she's also CEO of the Cosmos Foundation, carrying on the work of her late husband, the astronomer Carl Sagan. And Anne, did you ever ask yourself in the course of this project, what if some alien race out there eventually does find this record? What will they think of us?
Well, of course, you know, we thought about this day and night. You know, really, we wondered whether we should show the worst of ourselves, our violence, our poverty, our ignorance. We wondered if we should just put our best foot forward and try to, you know, put on a good face to the cosmos. And in the end, I think we realized that, you know, we're not such great liars. There are aspects of our personality that will come through no matter what we tell about ourselves. So we might as well just send what we think of as the best of ourselves. I just wanted to correct one minor thing, and that is it's not leaving the galaxy. That would be...
No. You're right. Yeah, that's not a minor. That's a major. It's leaving the solar system.
Leaving the solar system, right.
Right. So it's been 35 years, Anne, since the launch of Voyager 1 and 2. We've just, you know, we've seen NASA land Curiosity, the rover on Mars. If you had the chance, if NASA came calling and said, we're sending something out, you know, as far as we can, would you do it differently? Was there something that you were just dying to include on the Golden Record that you weren't able to do, or, you know, anything like that?
I think we would do it differently. I think there are, you know, there are a lot of different things that we would change, we would add, because, you know, after all, nobody's perfect, and we gave it our best shot back in 1977. And, you know, we've learned, I hope we've learned things since then. I'm very proud of Voyager. You know, I think that that as a labor of love, it stands up very well. And so I'm not renouncing any part of it, but I'm just saying that, you know, obviously there are so many more things we'd like to include. I was lucky enough to be at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory the night of the Curiosity landing several weeks ago. It was that electric thrill that went through everyone there, that feeling that, yes, you know, we have our problems, but look at what these little human beings on this tiny pale blue dot can actually accomplish. You know, we can do very difficult things. And I think that that's one of the byproducts of the space program, both unmanned and manned. Much greater than Tang and Teflon and some of the other things that, you know, people talk about, is the idea that we are still aspiring to do things that our ancestors could not have even dreamed of. And so I just want to say that I think that NASA has really done an amazing job. And the idea that there's room in a bureaucratic government administration for the romance of the Voyager record and all that it contains says something very, very good about NASA and about our civilization, I think, too.
And it was, in fact, a kind of romantic concept, sending these golden records out into the cosmos. Andrian was the creative director of NASA's Voyager interstellar message back in 1977. She was the co-writer of the original Cosmos series with her late husband, the astronomer Carl Sagan. And she's also the co-writer and executive producer of the new Cosmos series coming next year, Anne?
We haven't announced our air date, but I'm producing it with Seth MacFarlane and some others. It's going to star Neil deGrasse Tyson as our host narrator. Mm-hmm. And it will be 13 hours on Fox and National Geographic, and we are completely thrilled.
Well, Anne, I know that you have to get back to the JPL, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, a busy day for you, but thank you so much for taking some time to look back with us. It's really been a pleasure having you with us.
It's been so good talking with you, John. Thank you so much for having me.
This is Soundcheck. Blind Willie Johnson singing the song Dark Was the Night, Cold Was the Ground. That's just one of the many pieces of music included on the so-called Golden Record that NASA loaded onto Voyager 1 and Voyager 2. And you can find the entire playlist on our website at soundcheckworkshop.org. Still to come, the singer-songwriter Shara Warden joins us to play live in our studio. This is Soundcheck.
You were working for a man behind the velvet curtain. You were good and you were certain of what you were headed for. But then snap.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Remember the Venn diagram? You know, the two circles, they overlap a little bit. Well, if we made a Venn diagram consisting of indie rock in one circle and indie classical in the other, the band My Brightest Diamond would be right smack dab in the middle. My Brightest Diamond is the brainchild of singer-songwriter Shara Warden, and they just put out their third studio album last fall. It's called All Things Will Unwind. Today, Shara and My Brightest Diamond and the chamber group Y Music have all trooped into our studio to perform some of those songs for us. And Shara, it's good to see you again.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
A lot has happened. You know, you've moved from Brooklyn to Detroit. You've become a mom. Has the change in your life changed your music?
Definitely. I wanted to put myself in a different context. And
well, you did that literally.
Detroit is definitely a different context.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess because of living in a neighborhood that's very, very poor, and seeing, you know, a lot of suffering in the world as well, when I was writing this record, and simultaneously feeling tremendous amount of love and joy in my own life from having a child, those ideas kind of came together, kind of an examination of opposites.
Mm-hmm. And the title of the first song you and the two bands together are going to do is Be Brave. I mean, it takes some courage to move to a kind of blighted urban, you know, you said neighborhood, but a lot of your neighborhood is sort of not there, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's been a lot of abandonment. Be Brave was, yeah, kind of looking at environmental injustice and social injustice and beginning to ask myself how I was going to address those issues.
All right. Well, let's hear this song. We'll speak more with Shara in a moment. Shara Warden, the band My Brightest Diamond, featuring the New York chamber music sextet known as Y Music, live performance here in the Soundcheck studio of a song called Be Brave.
Thank you.
don my mask and finger bells. Shh, Shara, now get to work. Shh, Shara, this is going to hurt. Be brave, dear one. Be changed or be undone. Be brave, dear one. Be changed or be undone. Undone. I am a slave, I'm under house arrest. I am a beater or I'm beaten. For less than being punk and feeling anger swell. And so I don my beaded dress and finger bells. Shh, Shara, now get to work. Shh, Shara, this is going to hurt. Be brave, dear one. Be changed or be undone. Be brave, dear one. Be changed or be undone. Undone.
That is My Brightest Diamond, featuring Y Music, performing Shara Warden's song Be Brave, Shara singing, Brian Wolfe playing the drums, Chris Tarry playing the bass, and the members of Y Music with us today, violinist Rob Moose, flutist Alex Sopp, Hideaki Omori playing clarinet, Clarice Jensen playing the cello, Gareth Flowers on trumpet, and Max Mandel playing the viola, and Y Music is almost, they've almost become your band too, Shara. I mean, you've done a lot of work with this ensemble.
Yeah, we have worked together for a long time. Rob and I have been playing together for 8 years or something like that. So
when you write a song like Be Brave, are you actually composing the parts for the violin, the trumpet, the clarinet, etc. as well?
Yes, Be Brave was one of those, several of these songs I just wrote straight into Sibelius, so I arranged them first.
Sibelius, the computer program.
The computer program, yeah. Y Music actually bought me that computer program, because before the last two records, I wrote all the arrangements with pencil and paper, and it was excruciating.
Now, let me ask you about Be Brave. are you basically singing to yourself in that song?
Yeah, I think it's looking at behavioral change, and I felt like first, before I could say to anybody else to change, I had to address myself.
Mm-hmm. In the video for that song, which listeners, you can see on the Soundcheck website, you wear a mask, and, mm-hmm. and we see that mask on the cover of the record as well. I mean, there's a kind of theatrical element to this, in addition to having a sort of classical element and a rock element. So how does theater come into play in your music?
I'm really, really inspired by Lake Simons. She's a puppeteer here in New York, a director, and so I've tried to get Lake involved as much as possible, and she's been making me masks, and it's mm-hmm. fun.
Now, you have operatic training. It shows in your singing as well, but, you know, that's also drama and theater are part and parcel of that training. Is that where this comes from?
I think I've always been interested in the merging of different art forms, and so I feel like the whole of my musical and artistic life is really about finding out what happens when you mix things in a different way. I've been writing music for plays by Andrew André Jacques recently, and that's been a really interesting collaboration too. And
music for other people to play,
yes,
while the play.
Uh-huh.
That's a little bit of a different experience, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
So while you were still living here in New York, you were, you know, a central player on this really unusual scene where, you know, the indie rock musicians and the emerging classical chamber music players like the folks in Y Music were finding that they not only had common ground, but that basically they were pretty much the same people, you know. You'd have people playing in both worlds just as a matter of course. In Detroit, do you have a similar kind of community that's gestating now, that's building up now?
I have my very, very first kind of engagement with the chamber music community there coming up in September at the MOCAD, at the Modern Art Museum there. And there's a New Music Detroit. And so I'm just kind of beginning to build relationships there.
And still, obviously, coming back to New York frequently, playing with Y Music. And we're speaking with Shara Warden, the band My Brightest Diamond. The latest album is called All Things Will Unwind. It came out last fall. Coincidentally, Y Music's latest album, Beautiful Mechanical, also came out last fall, and they're here with Shara and the band as well. Now, this next song, High, Low, Middle, is this a Detroit song?
Absolutely, yeah.
How so?
I think it's looking at class, and Detroit makes you definitely consider class differences.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's hear another live performance from My Brightest Diamond and the chamber group Y Music. Shara Warden is the vocalist, the singer, and the songwriter behind High, Low, Middle. Here's a live performance on Soundcheck.
Not a lot. Are you fat?
not too low.
High, Low, Middle, a song written by Shara Warden, her band My Brightest Diamond, and the chamber music group Y Music, playing it live here in the studio. And Shara, that sounds like something that could just as easily have come from like 1940 or something, you know? Like, has this kind of mid-century jazzy swing flavor to it.
Well, the songs for this album were largely written for the American Songbook series.
At Lincoln Center.
Yes, yeah. We were asked to play that show, and so I wanted to look at the American Songbook and kind of reflect on that.
Mm-hmm. When you say we, do you mean My Brightest Diamond or, again, with Y Music?
Y Music was a part of that show.
So this wouldn't be the same song if it was two electric guitars, bass, and drums, you know, if it was like a conventional rock band.
Well, often we do perform it like that, and it still has some jazzy jazz flavor.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But does it become something else when the instrumentation is changed that drastically?
I think so, but it doesn't become a rock thing, I think. I think it still has a jazz inflection.
We're speaking with Shara Warden. The latest album from My Brightest Diamond is called All Things Will Unwind. You mentioned the American Songbook, the great American Songbook, Rodgers and Hart, Cole Porter, George and Ira Gershwin. Are there particular sort of iconic figures in that tradition who stand out for you?
I was thinking a lot about Bernstein, and for me, Samuel Barber is always an important figure for my music.
So Samuel Barber, not a songbook composer, but a great American classical composer, the famous Adagio for Strings, Knoxville Summer 1915. Bernstein, the Bernstein of Mass, or the Bernstein of West Side Story.
West Side Story.
Yeah. So you've been doing, you mentioned you've done some composition for the theater. The string quartet known as Brooklyn Rider has commissioned you to write a piece for them. So will that be a vocal work, or will that also be just like you as composer with a capital C?
I'm going to put on my big hat and put a big C on it. We decided that that Colin, the violinist from Brooklyn Rider, was going to write a piece for me to sing, but I was going to write a piece for them to play without me singing. So we're going to do a little exchange.
Very nice. And what is it absolute music? No kind of program to it, or is there an idea behind it?
Well, as if it were not intimidating enough to compose anything for Brooklyn Rider, it's also based on the Rite of Spring.
Really?
So, yeah. It's a 100-year celebration.
No one can accuse you, Shara, of lacking ambition. So your first string quartet will be inspired by one of the watershed moments in classical music history.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
I'll look for that in November, is that right?
Yes.
All right, so Brooklyn Rider, the string quartet, will be playing that work by Shara Warden. Meanwhile, we have one more song to do. Reaching Out Through the Other Side, Reaching Through to the Other Side, rather. What is this song? What's happening here?
Well, wouldn't we all like to know?
Okay. let's hear the song and see if we can figure it out. It's another live performance in the studio. My Brightest Diamond, Shara Warden, and Brian Wolf on drums, Chris Tarry playing the bass, with the six members of Y Music in a live performance on Soundcheck.
Hindrances, distresses of substance, I turn them over. Those forgotten, I remember and gather them up in my arms like some magic thing twisted and wind. Carries me on. Oh, how gorgeous, oh, how gorgeous to struggle now, to struggle now in time. Reaching through to the other side.
The song is called Reaching Through to the Other Side. Once again, Shara Warden and My Brightest Diamond, featuring the chamber music band known as Y Music, live on Soundcheck. And Shara, I began by asking you whether becoming a mom, moving to Detroit, all of this had affected your music. Is this one of those songs that maybe you wouldn't have written before becoming a mom?
Definitely, yeah. It was, I guess that's why it's hard to explain what it is about, because it is about birth and being alive and not being here anymore.
It's about everything, isn't it?
Yeah, it is about everything.
Yeah. Now, you texted or you tweeted a couple of days ago on your way to New York, in the van to NYC at hashtag 11-hour drive with toddler. How do you do that?
Thankfully, he loves books, so we do a lot of reading.
Okay. Well, Constantine is 2 now, right?
Yeah.
So not reading on his own yet, so...
No, it's a lot of mommy.
Okay. Well, Shara, it's amazing that you've been able to keep up all of the work, both with Y Music and with My Brightest Diamond. to say nothing of the upcoming work for the string quartet, Brooklyn Rider. I wish you the best of luck with that, and thank you for coming in with your bands, plural, to Soundcheck today.
Thank you.
This is Soundcheck.
Exhausting, inexhaustibles.
That song's called We Added It Up, from Shara Warden and her band My Brightest Diamond, and their album called All Things Will Unwind. Coming up, in August, the internet was abuzz about a prison sentence handed down to members of an all-female Russian punk band. We'll get an update on the reaction inside Russia next. This is Soundcheck. Soundcheck, I'm John Schaefer, and this part of the show contains a word that in some contexts isn't exactly family-friendly. See, back in August, 3 members of a Russian punk band were sentenced to 2 years in prison after a controversial performance in one of Moscow's major Orthodox cathedrals. But the story of this all-female collective, which calls itself Pussy Riot, isn't over yet. Joining me now in the studio is the New York Times' Robert Mackey. He's a reporter and editor for their blog, The Lead. Rob, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thanks, John.
So bring us up to speed for folks who maybe have heard the name Pussy Riot but didn't know what it was about. What are we talking about here?
Well, this is an all-female protest group that was formed specifically. They don't really perform except to protest. They were formed specifically to protest the Russian government and the kind of pretty obviously stage-managed return to power of Vladimir Putin. Or return to the presidency, rather, because
right.
People think he was in power all along. So they did a series of what might be called performance art stunts, as much as performances of songs, in the Russian subway system, in Red Square, outside a prison, and then ultimately in a very important Christian Orthodox church in Moscow. And in that performance, they called on the Virgin Mary to help them by ridding Russia of Vladimir Putin.
Mm-hmm.
And they used a couple of obscene words. And they posted a version of that song, a video of them performing it in the cathedral on YouTube, which attracted a lot more attention than the actual protest.
And which attracted some perhaps initially wanted but ultimately unwanted attention from the Russian government. and ended up with them being sentenced to 2 years in prison for this stunt. Now, it's a little hard to make out, but here's some audio of Pussy Riot's protest taking place in Moscow's Christ the Savior Cathedral. This was last February, and then you'll hear a little bit of the recording of the song that the band was singing during that protest, which they call Punk Prayer. So that's the Russian collective known as Pussy Riot, and their punk prayer, the sort of the refrain, Rob, translates as drive away Putin, that sort of
that's
sentiment.
That's right, and they also call on the Virgin Mary to act as a feminist at the beginning of the...
So August 17th, they're convicted of, quote-unquote, hooliganism driven by religious hatred.
That's right.
So this brings up several things that we've seen playing out over the subsequent couple of weeks. First, the close relationship between Vladimir Putin and the Russian Orthodox Church, and then a sort of growing and increasingly violent rift between Russian Orthodox Christians, conservative Christians on the one hand, and the more liberal-leaning Pussy Riot supporters on the other.
Well, that's right. I mean, one central element, I think, of the way that the Russian state responded was to treat this entirely as a protest against the church itself. They completely omitted and never really mentioned that it was targeting Vladimir Putin. The women were arrested, the three women from the band. There are a couple who are still at large and apparently have left Russia. But the women were arrested on the eve of Putin's election as president again. But since then, the entire way that the church, the church and state have dealt with this protest is as if it was directed at mocking and denigrating believers in Russian Orthodox Christianity.
Well, I mean, you know, if you watch the video online, I mean, these women, they're dressed in these hoods, these balaclavas, they're up on the altar of the cathedral, and they're sort of making these mocking sort of, you know, signs of the cross and stuff as they're chanting. I mean, and in the video you can see sort of older women who are there in church to pray, and they're sort
That's
of
right.
baffled by all of this. I mean, you know, they did this song outside of prison, on the subway, all the other places you mentioned. At some point, they were being sort of knowingly transgressive here, weren't they?
Well, that's right. And they actually come from, the women are associated previously with a performance art group, a radical collective called Voyna, which is the Russian word for war. And they've done a lot of previous performance art stunts that are often sexual and transgressive in nature. They painted a huge penis on the bottom of a drawbridge so that when the bridge was raised, it would point at the local headquarters of the Secret Service. They had an orgy in the Zoological Museum, supposedly to protest the previous regime of Medvedev. And what's happened since then, which is interesting, is when the issue of Pussy Riot was raised today in an interview with the state-sponsored television channel Russia Today, or RT, which we can see here, Vladimir Putin did an exclusive interview with them, and they used part of that interview to raise the question of Pussy Riot. And Putin stressed two things. First of all, he acted as though he didn't really know and asked the host to explain what the first word of their name means and to see if he could translate it into Russian. The English-speaking host demurred, and they made some jokes about cats and things. But then he also focused very strongly on the idea that the group was attacking Christianity and that they were essentially sexual degenerates. Mm-hmm. So the kind of idea is to denigrate them, but again, to continually avoid the idea that their protests had anything to do with him.
He said, you know, the state is obliged to protect the feelings of the faithful. Now, the faithful have very much, and this is something you've covered on the blog, The Lead, is the faithful have taken matters into their own hands, and we're seeing a kind of backlash, which seems to be pretty carefully orchestrated, because everywhere these people go, it seems there's state television cameras with them.
That's right. There's a sort of a very small group. I mean, you call it a handful of activists, really, of youth activists. I mean, you have what you have are seeing is that the internet is being used by Putin's opponents, in smart and often transgressive ways, like this Pussy Riot protest and in other ways. And then there's been some sort of attempt to use the same techniques to make the opposite message, to transmit the opposite message, most recently by about four or five Russian Orthodox Christians who were a figurehead. You know, they were a constant presence outside the trial during the Pussy Riot trial. And then they started doing stunts that they documented themselves, walking up to someone wearing a Pussy Riot T-shirt in a train station, ripping it off the person as he was wearing it, or just pulling it right off him. Then did launch two other interventions, kind of planned stunts, one of which was bursting into a theater that was performing a play, but basically a discussion of Pussy Riot with people involved in the case. They burst in and shouted, "Repent," and "Why do you hate the Russian people?" Disrupting that. And when they showed up, they were accompanied by a crew from state television.
Mm-hmm.
So it has a version, it has something that, you know, we might see as this sort of techniques used by an activist like James O'Keefe. But there's another way in which it's sort of like a Russian version of the show Punked, where people are, it's like a candid camera thing. And everywhere they turn up, the next day they barged into a sex museum in Moscow, whose owner is a known supporter of Pussy Riot, and threatened the staff and, you know, basically, you know, were confrontational. And again, they were accompanied by a crew from Russian television.
Right. And as you report on your blog, they left a brick.
That's right.
No, which, you know, in terms of like bad behavior, leaving a brick, heaving a brick would be one thing, but leaving a brick in a museum is...
That's right. Although they did, it was interesting. I mean, I'm not sure exactly. I read this part through translation. They supposedly said something about this being the first stone, making a Christian reference,
okay,
which
so
is a
they're...
kind of unclear Christian reference, but it was, yeah.
All right. So some threatening acts happening really on both sides, and both sides using... not just old media like cameras and TV crews, but new media. I mean, what does this say about the internet as a way of sort of blowing up all of these, you know, small brush fires into huge global conflagrations?
Well, the thing in Russia specifically is that previously, because the state controls most of the media, most of the television stations, including Russia Today, which is an English-language satellite channel we see here, but it's sponsored by the Russian Information Agency, an arm of the Kremlin. Because of that control of the state media, the opposition's complained for years that they don't really have any fair shake at presenting their case. And they've made quite smart use of YouTube and of social networks. People use Twitter. Alexei Navalny, an important blogger there, uses Twitter. And there's a Live Journal, which is an early blogging platform, is now owned by a Russian company, and is very popular there. And then these acts, the Russian Orthodox activists, these couple of guys, have been very proudly documenting what they're doing on something called VKontakte, or VK, which is essentially looks exactly like Facebook. It's like a Russian version of Facebook.
So it's all happening online, but actually it's happening. I mean, we've seen artists like Björk and Madonna doing concerts and performances in support of the band Pussy Riot. Vladimir Putin also said today, "I know what is going on with Pussy Riot, but I am staying out of it completely." The three convicted band members have since appealed their sentences. We'll see what happens. 2 years, including time served, was their original sentence for hooliganism driven by religious hatred. And we've been speaking with Robert Mackey. He's reporter and editor for the New York Times blog, The Lead. Rob, it's a still unfolding story. Thanks for keeping us up to date on it.
Thank you.
And this is the song that members of Pussy Riot released on the day of their sentencing. It's called "Putin Lights Up the Fires."
Государство в тюрьме, сильнее времени. Чем больше арестов, тем больше счастья. А каждый арест с любовью к сексисту. Качнувшему щеки, как грудь и живот. Нас нельзя закупорить ящик, тягачики, нам лучше чаще. Путин зажигает костры революции.
Well, as Rob mentioned, Vladimir Putin was trying to put the focus on the first part of Pussy Riot's name, but the second part shows their American influences. Riot, referring to the feminist punk movement known as Riot Girl, which started in the Pacific Northwest in the 90s.
Sound check, 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 check. Sound check, 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 check. Sound check.
Tell me what's on your mind.
Before we go, it's time for you to tell us what's on your mind. What would you like to hear us talk about on Soundcheck? Put on your producer hat and give us the burning issue in the music world that we've overlooked or just need to pay more attention to. Who's your dream interview? Email us with your big idea, soundcheck@wnyc.org, or leave us a voicemail, 646-493-7939. If we use your idea, we'll let you know and give you a shout-out. That email again, soundcheck@wnyc.org, and our voicemail box is 646-493-7939. That's going to do it for today. Our technical director is Irene Trudell. The show is produced by Greta Cohn and Katie Bishop. Our digital producer is Mike Katziff. Our senior producer is Joel Meyer. Our jingles today came from our listeners John McMahon and Astral. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.
You're listening to Soundcheck. You're listening to Sound with John Schaefer. You're listening to Soundcheck. You're listening to Soundcheck.